everyone, and welcome to episode 63 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sabalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Before we get into some really cool stuff, I want to let you know about a sweet deal just for you from Skillshare, because while we're all stuck at home, why not learn something new? Skillshare has over 20,000 classes to take online so you can keep yourself busy learning everything from drawing to writing to how to become more productive. Classes are offered as videos and Zoom workshops, and you can even join groups to help keep you learning and keep you motivated. Want to try it out? Well, you are in luck, my friends, because just for being here, you can try Skillshare out for free for 2 whole months. Just go to medievalist.net/Skillshare and let the learning begin. If I asked you to draw a picture of the Middle Ages, what are the odds that the picture you drew me would be of a knight on horseback? I think one of the most common images we carry in our minds of the Middle Ages is a mounted knight in colorful array, charging flat out with a couched lance. And really, who could blame us? The tournament was an exciting and thrilling event for people from all walks of life, a combination of martial arts and creative arts that brought people together. Sometimes, as you'll soon hear, even bitter political rivals. This week, I invited Dr. Emma Levitt to speak to us about tournaments, especially jousting, and how it worked. Emma is a postdoc at the University of Huddersfield and has written about jousting for both BBC History Magazine and History Today. Her work focuses on masculinity and the tournaments of Edward IV and Henry VIII. Here's our conversation about tournaments, nasty splinters, and how to make friends and influence people through jousting. Thanks, Emma, for joining me to talk about tournaments. I'm super excited, jousting especially. I'm super excited to talk about it because I love jousting, love tournaments. Although I like to look at it back in the original sources. I don't watch the new ones on TV. I don't know if you watch those either. Have you seen any of those?
One of my favorite films, to be fair, is A Knight's Tale.
Mine too.
Yeah, so I do definitely recommend A Knight's Tale, even though it's slightly anachronistic with the whole sort of We Will Rock You and Queen at the beginning. I really enjoy it, and I especially enjoy sort of the Geoffrey Chaucer sort of herald, all the announcements that he gives, which are really over the top. So I think as far as Knight's Tale, we can like make an exception.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. I think anybody who's listened to the podcast has heard that more than once. Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. How did the tournament come about, and how did the joust become part of the tournament?
Yeah, so tournaments really start around sort of the 11th and 12th century, but they're not how we would envision a tournament today. So they were called back then the melee-style tournaments, where you would have hundreds of knights on two opposing sides and on a given signal sort of crashing into each other. You would have knights that would be captured and horses and held as ransom. And this really replicate what happened on the battlefield. So it was very much like a mock combat, if you like, a mock battle. It wasn't really confined to a set field even. There weren't rules. There was no point scoring system. It'd be really difficult to identify a victor or someone who was performing particularly well. So I guess as a spectator sport, it'd be quite difficult to watch in a way, because it was really kind of bloodthirsty. The armour that you'd be wearing would be your field armour. There wouldn't really be much distinction between that style of tournament and actually what you would witness on a medieval battlefield. So the tournament really evolves across the medieval period. And really by the 15th century, what we have is, I guess, something that really replicates what you see in A Knight's Tale, for example. So you have these three forms of combat, which are quite distinct. The first style of combat is a joust, which I guess is kind of the high point of any tournament. And that's the competition that everyone really wants to take part in. And actually, you see that in A Knight's Tale, because that's the one that he really wants to focus on. He wants to just be in the joust and compete in the joust. The second style is the tourney, and the third style is the foot combat. So I can explain a little bit what these are for people who might not know. So your joust is your single man-to-man combat. Earlier on in the 13th century, this would take place without a tilt barrier. So it was still highly dangerous. Lots of injuries, accidents would happen. And there are two variant forms of the joust as well. So you might have a joust of war, where you have men who fight with sharp spears. highly dangerous. Or you might have a joust of peace where you have knights who will combat against each other with blunted spears. So that's a single combat, is a joust, and that's a mounted combat on horseback, in the armour with a lance. So that's probably what we're used to seeing these days. And obviously that's more exciting to watch because you just got those two men, and it's really competitive. And by the 15th century, we do have that tilt barrier that then gets added. But that tends to be the most popular form of combat, I would say. The tourney is a broken down version, really, of the Malay style tournament that I talked about in the 12th century. So you have groups of knights on horseback, and it tends to be with clubs or staffs or swords most commonly. And they'll compete against each other in sort of groups, mini groups of knights. And then the final stage tends to be the foot combat, which is just as it sounds, really. It's just hand-to-hand, on-foot combat. And that might be with axes, it might be with swords. It all depends what's being written down in the tournament challenge. So by the 15th century, it's slightly more complex because you have these three styles of combat. It's much more of a spectator sport in that sense. Knights can sign up to all three or individual challenges, depending on what they kind of specialise in. And the armour itself is more distinct. So you would need specialised bespoke armour for those contests. You might buy one set of armour that has different component parts, where you can change certain parts of the armour to fit in with the different styles of combat, which a lot of knights did do because tournament armour was very expensive. But you definitely couldn't wear your field armour in the 15th and 16th centuries for tournaments anymore. So yeah, it was completely different by the 15th century.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of the armour that you see in museums, the really fancy stuff is the tournament armour, because you can wear the really fancy stuff on the battlefield, but on the tournament field, you want to show off, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this tournament armour could cost a lot. So it's plate armour by the 15th century. And if you compare it to field armour would weigh about 25 kilos, tournament armour could weigh up to 50 kilos. So it's very, very heavy, not really practical for medieval warfare when you're, you know, being thrown off a horse and having to fight on foot. Like you said, you have the fancy crests, engravings. A tilting armour could set you back, you know, about 10 and 12 pounds, where field armour might be around 8 pounds. And a yearly income would be around £2. So you definitely have to have a certain degree of wealth and status to be able to afford this equipment and to be able to enter into tilt yard. So it's certainly not a sport for those of low status. Not everyone is of noble status, but you definitely were of a middling status. So you would have to be from a knightly background, not only for the training, but just the cost involved of having a trained tournament horse, which were expensive. For having this armour as well that was specialised for these activities.
Yeah, and one of the ways that you could get more money is to win at these tournaments, right? Because they had pretty big prizes. And at the beginning, when you beat someone, when you ransomed them, you could take their horse. Is that one of the things that continued as tournaments went on?
No, they're actually very precious about the horses. So as quite rightly, having a trained tournament horse is definitely not a small cost. So the horses can vary. I mean, they can be between anywhere from about £6 up to £20, half ton horses. The horses are actually written into the rules. So if you were to strike a horse, you would actually be disqualified and you would lose points. So that definitely changes, but the prizes are still pretty luxurious. Interestingly, so a lot of the prizes that I've looked at, they're all prizes that can be worn as well. So they tend to be things like ruby rings are popular, diamond rings, gold chains, gold clasps, silver belts. So I guess in terms of thinking about sort of like manhood and masculinity, you could really wear these prizes and kind of show off that you had been successful in a joust or a foot combat. And presumably it was a really good talking point at court where you could kind of sort of show off your ruby ring and explain how you'd been successful in a tournament. I guess it's kind of similar towards, I guess, for the Olympics, how you have, you know, the winners stand there on the podium with their, you know, bronze or silver or gold medals. These were kind of medals of having been successful in the sport. And also, yeah, were worth a lot of money as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, how it's wearable, something that you get. It's meant to bring up conversation because you do see this in a lot of sports as well, where you get a big ring if you win the championship, right? Or in the combat sports, you get a big gold belt and you're supposed to at least wear it or display it so that people can see it. It's funny how that still exists. You were talking about the point system, and I want to get into that as well because if we go back to A Knight's Tale, they explain what the point system is. What kind of points or scoring would you have in a tournament, especially in a joust?
Yeah, so in 1466, Edward the Fourth is on the throne in England, and he really revived tournaments and jousts in particular at his court. So he is a new king to the throne, and he comes to the throne around 19, and he's 6 foot 4, so he's like the tallest English monarch. He's really muscular, really strapping. He's won his throne on the battlefield, and he's really engaged in this chivalric culture. So he asks the Earl of Worcester, a man called John Tiptoft, who's been travelling in Italy, and the Italians have put together a set of rules. And actually, it seems that he's kind of framed these rules on the Italian version, and he brings it over to England, and he puts together a similar set of rules. And it makes sense because when you have tournaments in the medieval period, a bit like the Olympics, where you have knights travelling from all over, as you see on A Knight's Tale, it would make sense that you had rules that were quite formulaic that other knights in different countries were used to sort of abiding by. So there are points that you can win. So if you break a spear on the body of your opponent in the joust, that would count for 1 point. If you break a spear on the head, that would count for 2 points. Obviously, that's a harder target. And these horses could get up to about 25 miles per hour. So on the moment of impact, you're looking at about 50 miles an hour. Plus you're carrying a lance that's probably weighing about 10 pounds. You've got limited vision. So to get a hit on the head, is hugely someone who's got skill and technique. If you break a spear coronal to coronal, or the tip of the lance to tip of the lance, that would count for 3. And if you unhorse a man, that counts as 3 as well. So it's definitely quantified in terms of these points. And I think it kind of then dispels all these sort of misbeliefs about how anybody could just compete in a tournament. And if you were a king like Edward the Fourth, you would just automatically win because of your status. But actually, men are quantified in terms of their skill, not their status. So whoever, makes the most hits on the head or breaks the most spears is going to win a prize. It's not just about getting on a horse and running down the tilt yard and on a horse and a man. There is actually points, and you have to hit certain parts of the body as well. Equally, there are also points that are disallowed that are set out in the rules as well. So I mentioned earlier about the horses. So yes, if you were to strike a horse, you would lose a point. If you hit the tilt barrier, you're going to lose 2 points. If you hit it twice, you're going to lose 3 points. If you hit a man below his saddle, again, you're going to lose a point. So it was really regulated in that sense, which is a completely different environment compared to like the Malay tournaments where, there are really no rules at all and you are kidnapping knights and horses. So yeah, so he sets these down, and it's interesting because these rules are copied down in the 15th century, the 16th century. I found them in manuscripts, even to the 17th century. So they really continue across right into the early modern period. And this is kind of the formalized way of scoring jousts in England.
It's good to know because, like you say, tournaments evolve over so much time, and you do want to kind of have an idea of how do they decide who is going to win. It's not always that someone's going to end up on their back. Who was it that decided the points? Like, who was it that scored them for the tournament?
So generally it'll be the heralds. The heralds are in a good position. They're almost like kind of sports commentators, referees, kind of watching the play-by-play. So you would have heralds who would watch the challengers. Now the challengers are the knights who have kind of challenged other men to compete. So you might have 2 to 4 or 2 to 6 challengers. And then the answerers, the opposing team, all those knights who have answered the challenge. So it kind of makes sense, answerers, challengers. So you might have one herald or two heralds writing down the points for the challengers, and then another two heralds writing down points for the answerers. But they would score them, and then they would go to whoever was hosting the event. So a lot of the tournaments in England tend to be royal sponsored occasions, so it might be the king. Noble ladies, the queen, would often announce who had been successful in a tournament, but they again definitely did not decide who won. It was based on those points. So you can imagine them having kind of like a league table, and it might, joust might last 2 or 3 days or up to a week. So you can see them sort of tallying it and keeping score, maybe displaying them on, you know, a chalkboard or something, a bit like your Knight's Tale. And then, yeah, and seeing how high they've got. So, yeah, you'd have them as kind of like your referees, if you like, the heralds.
I love it. I wouldn't have thought that a herald would get that job because, you know, it sounds like a very important job when there's all this honor involved. But it's great to know who is doing the scoring. I do want to come back to the rules for a second because, like you're saying, in the early tournaments, there aren't that many rules. I'm thinking of William Marshall being at a tournament, and because he was worth a lot, there were 5 knights who were coming after him at once. Like, it's crazy, yeah. Chaos. But as time went on, things got safer. And we were talking earlier about how people have an idea that these fights are to the death or something like that, but actually things got safer. So can you talk about how it evolved to make things a little bit safer for the knights who were competing?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big safety measures that is put in place is that tilt bar in the 15th century, because you can't then have 2 knights that are crashing into each other because you have that separation. Also, these points and these rules that are written down, you know, if men are not abiding by them, they'll be disqualified from competitions. Alterations are made with the saddle, so it's higher. So the idea is no longer you're knocking a man completely out of his saddle. The idea tends to be, as we move forward, actually you're just getting points from hitting him. So it's not like the trials where you would fight to the death for your innocence. That is a completely different method of fighting, really. It's more about technique and skill and making these hits and showcasing that you have the accuracy, especially with limited vision, especially with the speed at which they're doing it. That is safeguarding. And I think as well, because you have men of nobility who take part in the 15th and 16th century, and you have kings that are taking part, you can't risk Edward the Fourth being in the tilt yard and potentially being killed, or Henry the Eighth, or great landowners. So that is put in place as well to protect the types of men that do take part, because you do get a lot of nobility who do take part in these competitions, whereas back in the Malay tournament you would get, you know, hundreds of competitors, but men who are not the same worth and standing. So you wouldn't get a royal king competing in a Malay tournament, but you do get them in the single combat of the joust.
Yeah, and they could be dangerous. I mean, back in the early days of the tournament, I think it was Richard the Lionheart's brother Geoffrey, I think, died in a tournament. And so maybe people were like, oh, then King John came to the throne, so maybe we should make it safer. Yeah. But you said that people often ask you about injuries. You were telling me earlier, people are always asking about splinters in the eye. So let's get into it. What kind of injuries do people get from being on the tournament circuit?
Yeah, so, I mean, a really common one is definitely having splinters in the eye. I mean, it's interesting, because we speak about kings and men of status, and actually, I mean, even to the 16th century, later in the 16th century, in 1559, you've got Henry II of France, and he dies from a jousting accident because he gets a long splinter in his eye that pierces his eye, and he dies later. I mean, the famous ones, I guess, that everyone always knows about is, you know, Henry VIII, obviously, he has 2 jousting accidents. One, the 1520s, where he actually sets off without lowering his visor, and it's a new visor, and he sets off, and the other knights set off, and he's not aware that his visor isn't down, and he literally puts his lance straight into the king's face, shatters spears all through his face. He's actually all right after that accident, and he carries on jousting Henry just to get, I guess, to sort of prove his manhood, if you like. And he runs more courses with the same knight as well. But then in 1536, he has a jousting accident where he comes completely off his horse. The horse falls on top of him. He's unconscious. They think he's dead. Obviously, he has that huge ulcer on his leg, and that affects him for the rest of his reign. There's other examples, again, into the 16th century. I mean, we've just commemorated the Field of Cloth of Gold in 1520. That's a huge tournament that happens between the French and the English king. And a Frenchman, he dies in the joust at Field of Cloth of Gold, which is all about diplomacy. And yet we've got this death of a French knight. And there are other examples of knights who lose eyes. One, again, in Henry VIII's reign. Francis Bryan is called, in 1526. He has a lance that spears into his eye and he loses his eye. So, yeah, I mean, even though it has evolved in the 15th and 16th century, and you do have these rules, you have point scoring system, you have a tilt barrier, it still is incredibly dangerous. And actually, when I was doing research, obviously today we have modern jousts and we have a lot of safety measures that are put in place. But I think it was back in about 2011 where Time Team were filming a show and one of the jousters got splintered in the eye, suffered brain damage and died from filming that programme. So even today, it's still incredibly dangerous as a sport. I know today when they do reenactments, they don't tend to aim for the head, it is just the body. But yes, still, it's a highly dangerous sport.
Yes, everybody, don't try this at home.
Yes, warning.
Do not try this at home. Okay, so you gave me a preview of a chapter that you'd written about tournaments in the age of Edward IV, and maybe you can give us a little bit of a background on why it was so important for him to run these tournaments. But the gist of it was that Edward IV in the 15th century in England, he is trying to bring the country together. The country's been divided, and he's trying to bring them together through tournaments. So tell us a little bit about that situation.
Yeah, so Edward comes to the throne in 1461 and he actually usurps the throne. And it's quite a unique situation because in the 15th century, the throne of England changes a number of times. And it's quite an unusual situation because you have Edward IV who comes to the throne, but you still have his rival who is still alive. And we've not had that before, which is Henry VI. And so he brings together this new sort of Yorkist dynasty. He's from the House of York. But the House of Lancaster, which is where Henry VI has been from, that has been, his house has been on the throne for about 62 years. So it's a long time of Lancastrian rule. So you've got the famous Henry V who comes from there, Henry IV. So that's why we have that coined term of the Wars of the Roses happening in England during this time, the two houses of York and Lancaster. So Edward IV, he has to stabilise the country because the country's been at civil war and they've been fighting against each other. And so he's in an unusual situation that he becomes king and he's got men in his court who are both Lancastrians and Yorkists who have been fighting each other prior to him coming to the throne. So what he does, which I wrote about that hasn't been looked at before, is that he actually uses tournaments as a way to kind of cement bonds between these men. So it's quite a clever technique because you've got men who are clearly interested in fighting, but he doesn't want them fighting the battlefield anymore. So he makes them fight in the tilt yard. So at least it's confined and he kind of channels that kind of aggression into a sporting way, I guess, and those energies. And he also, it helps to form bonds of loyalty between the men, because if you are fighting against a man in the tilt yard, you have to trust that they're not going to try and kill you, that they're going to stick to those rules and in the confines of that tilt yard. So it's a way for him to really bond the men of his court together. And it's also a way to bond his men to him as well, because he decides that he's going to take part. And this is highly unusual because it's not really been for about 50 years that we've had tournaments, really big tournaments in England, until we have Edward IV. So we have this real revival of chivalry in this sport and activity. Henry VI, his rival, has had no interest in tournaments at all, couldn't be further from it as a king. He's very much about sort of religiosity and peacefulness. He doesn't look like a typical medieval king should. Edward IV very much looks like a medieval knight, if you like. So there's a little bit of PR, I think, happening there as well for Edward. It kind of makes him look good against his rival. And it also kind of draws on those kind of warrior kings that are kind of being revered in the 15th century when chivalry is kind of beyond decline. So harkening back to the days of Edward III, Henry V, these big warriors who are fighting with France. And Edward III took part in tournaments. And now we have another Edward who's taking part. In between, we've had tournaments that have been held, but kings haven't taken part. So it is highly unusual in a way that we now have this king in the 15th century bringing tournaments back after 40 years and also taking part in them. And it's clearly a way as well for him to establish those relationships with his men. Because in the tilt yard, these men are equal. They're judged by the skill, not the status. As we talked about, it's about the rules. And Edward has to trust these men not to kill him. So he puts himself against Lancastrians who have been fighting on the battlefield. He now fights against in the tilt yard. So it is a way for him to establish bonds, and he uses it in a way that hasn't perhaps been used before, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of things that you're bringing up that are really important. Like back in the early days of the tournament, you'd have a lot of second sons and you did want to distract them from military stuff. Like, don't go raiding somewhere else. Go do a tournament. That'll keep you busy. But yeah. In the time of Edward IV, these are all the first sons. These are all the heirs. And they have a lot of feelings about the Wars of the Roses, and they need to channel that. And again, as you said in your article or your chapter, Edward IV has a lot of people who are not quite common, but they're not at the elite level of the nobility, and he's trying to consolidate their loyalty as well. So I think that's a really interesting thing. And one of the things you mentioned is that for once, this is a very young court. Just about everybody is young because of the Wars of the Roses. Do you think that had something to do with the success of the tournaments and the bond building?
Yeah, definitely, because I think to tournaments, to compete, it tends to be younger men. So I'd say sort of early 20s, you do get men in their 30s, but a bit like sporting events today, you know, a lot of men are retiring by the age of 40, which obviously is only middle-aged, but that's quite an age for the medieval period. And you definitely don't really get examples of men kind of competing in like the late 40s or 50s. Obviously, it is individual, and it depends how much a man really kind of, I guess, works out and keeps himself in shape. But it would involve, you know, a lot of training, both, you know, horsemanship skills, upper body arm strength, stamina. You would have to be riding a heck of a lot daily, being able to, you know, carry the weight of this 50 kilo armour in the heat, especially if you're doing foot-to-foot combat, plus, you know, carrying a lance, which could be, like I said, 10 pounds in weight. It could be up to 9 feet in length. So it is really a younger man's sport. And I think as well, younger men tend to be a little bit more reckless in a way, because they don't perhaps have families, and they can be maybe a little bit more kind of free in their youthful energies and maybe take risk a little bit more than what someone who has got, you know, maybe someone who's a bit later in life, who's got an established family and land ownings. So these men really see it as a way to advance themselves at court. So they're prepared to take risks to establish a friendship with the king and also to advance themselves as well. So they've definitely got a motive for taking part in tournaments beyond just the fact they just kind of want to, you know, take part in sports. There's definitely a political aspect to this as well.
Yeah, and I think that's super important. And we're going to tell people what the book is so they can read this for themselves later. Okay, so you and I, we both love A Knight's Tale. So it's probably time to talk about the role of the common people in the tournament. So we have a lot of common people showing up in A Knight's Tale. What is the role of the common people in tournament in the Middle Ages, the real Middle Ages?
Yeah, so, I mean, tournaments are definitely a huge spectator sport. And thinking about the chapter in Edward IV, so he holds the biggest tournament of the age in 1467, and this is at Smithfield. And he declares a public holiday for the 2 days that the tournament's taking part. And so when you have the tilt yard, it's interesting because you have seating, and a lot of the commoners complained about the cost of this seating. They couldn't afford it, sort of the expensive seats, the cushioned seats at the back, or even the seats. So you have them kind of stood around the tilt yard barrier, a lot of the commoners, or even some would like climb trees, you know, look out of houses, as you see on the film, to really get a glimpse of the knights in action. So they were there as part of the crowd, cheering on these knights. Now, I imagine you might have your favourite knight who you've come to watch and come to support, and you might be in their corner. But it's important for the knights, as part of their masculinity and their status, that it's a parade as well, as a showcasing. So the parades that would take place in the 15th and 16th century, all the pageantry around this, they would dress up their horses, they would dress up, they would be in these huge crests showing their coats of arms. The parade around the list was as important as the fighting activity, because that's how you build up that support. And it was important that men were seen to be popular. especially if you wanted a place at Edward's court, that you were popular. And equally, a lot of these men will end up being advanced into the Order of the Garter, which is a really prestigious honour in England during this period. And it's only 25 knights that can be a part of this order. So if you're showcasing how fabulous you are around the tilt yard, how popular you are with the people, the fact that you're also a really good contender in the tilt yard, this is all going to add to your status and reputation. And it's really important that Edward has people in positions of authority who are respected and liked. So they do have an important part to play.
I would think that as well. You know, people are there and they're picking a knight because you've seen them over the course of a couple of days that are fighting against more than one competitor, and you'll see them, see how well they're doing and pick your knight. Who's going to win this? Who's going to get the most points? And I do imagine that you have people who are totally low status that know everything about jousting and how to score it and how they're scoring it for themselves on the side, I have no doubt. So tournaments eventually declined. What do you think was responsible for the decline of the tournament, kind of their disappearance over the next couple centuries?
Yes, this is a really big question, actually. And it's something that I wrote recently for BBC History Magazine. Someone wrote in this exact question. And really, after sort of dominating the medieval world for about six centuries, they do tend to run their course by the 17th century, and they really do fall out of fashion. And I think there's a few reasons for this. So there's a decline, really, of the importance of the man-at-arms on the battlefield. So you've got the efficiency of firearms by the early modern periods, by the 16th, 17th century. And so the tilt yard really doesn't replicate any more medieval warfare, and those skills are no longer seen on the battlefield because you have that increase on firearms. So I think that's one explanation, I think. And the other one is that that whole pageantry and masks and banquets and feasts, that really takes over the actual fighting activity, and that becomes kind of more important, really, the pageantry side of it. So the fighting is less so, and you definitely have more of the pageantry side. So again, what you see in the tilt yard is no longer sort of replicating real training for military warfare or real exercise of those skills, because it is much more sort of a pretense by that point as well. A lot of it's driven by the personality of kings as well. So although in even the 16th century, we have Elizabeth, we have a queen on the throne in England, and we do have tournaments that take part with her nobles, it seems that those nobles who are really kind of keeping chivalry alive, they all pass on, and it's no longer an active ideal chivalry anymore, as it was under Edward IV and even Henry VIII, who really wanted to be a medieval king in lots of ways. The kings throughout Europe and princes, they don't practice chivalry anymore. They don't sponsor those tournaments. So they do survive up until the 17th century, but I think there's no real fighting activity anymore. Firearms on the battlefield make almost these knightly charges a bit obsolete. And this all kind of signals an end to jousting. Other equestrian sports become more popular and replace them.
That's what I was thinking as well. I think that firearms have a lot to do with it, but you've outlined a whole bunch of other reasons I think are just as valid. Well, I really want to thank you for coming and talking to us about tournaments and jousting especially. It's been really, really fun, and I think everybody is going to really have learned something from this. So thank you so much, Emma.
Welcome. Thank you. I enjoy it. I always love talking about jousting, so any excuse.
Same here. Emma's chapter on Edward IV is called Tilt Yard Friendships and Bonds of Loyalty in the Reign of Edward IV, circa 1461 to 1471. And it's featured in the forthcoming book, Loyalty to the Monarchy in Late Medieval and Early Modern Britain, circa 1400 to 1688, from Palgrave Macmillan. For more of Emma's work, you can follow her on Twitter at evlevitt. That's E-V-L-E-V-I-T-T. Or you can check out her work on academia.edu at hud.academia.edu/Emma Levitt. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
We're doing well here on medievalist.net. And there's one post I want to talk about is that if you're like me you're like deeply missing going to libraries and bookstores. Like I really have to get my next book hit. So, you know, what I did or what we did was we looked up new things to read, new books you can read that are actually available for free to download online. So these are books that are open source, been published within the last year and deal with medieval studies. And so we've found stuff like ones that deal with medieval London. There's a 14th century Middle English text on medicine. And there's also another book on hostages in the Viking era. So we've got a list of 10 of them that I think people will enjoy. We're going to try and do this every once in a while and make a kind of list of these things that people can find online for free. So
I already checked out that list and I got to tell you, it is awesome. I'm so grateful that you did that, man. It's a great list. Wow, those books are awesome.
Oh, yeah. Like I came across a few more, so I do have room to put more, and I really enjoyed searching around. And like, it seems every publisher has one or two books that are open source, and there's others that are dedicated to that, and that's a really good service. So you can read the digital version for free, or you want to buy the print copy.
Thanks so much for doing this for all of us who are stuck at home. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks.
Okay, bye. Thank you to our growing army of patrons on Patreon.com who make it possible for this podcast to keep bringing you all the coolest bits of the medieval world. Patrons can get all sorts of sweet deals like an ad-free desktop version of medievalist.net, subscriptions to one of two awesome magazines, or a membership in our book club. Every little bit helps yours truly keep this up, and every bit is appreciated. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For all the latest information about the medieval world, as well as links to amazing free book downloads, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. For more indoor learning and entertainment, you can find my books on Amazon or through your local bookstore. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.